finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Lowe's knows that more projects mean more tools. For a limited time, new and existing MyLowe's Rewards credit card members can get 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more, in-store and online. Don't wait to get the things you need. Get special financing today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Now through August 27th, choose 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more. Offer subject to credit approval and cannot be combined. Minimum monthly payments required. See store or Lowe's.com for details.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Orla Reed, who has 20 years of experience of working in the field of complementary health, psychology and coaching. She is a qualified coach, accredited counsellor and psychotherapist, addiction and recovery therapist and group facilitator in private practice, working mostly online with her clients and groups in and out of Ireland. Areas of passion are in women's health, clinical sexology and alcohol recovery and freedom. Today we're talking all about alcohol use disorder and how this can often correlate with disordered eating. We talk about the nuanced and complex conversation around alcohol and eating disorders and how actually building awareness and looking at it from your own individual perspective is the most important when it comes to navigating your relationship with them. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It's so nice to have you. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm really good because we're in summer. And I'm just loving all this great weather. We all have so much more energy and bandwidth. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's interesting you say that because I normally have so much energy with this weather, but I think maybe because I'm doing so much more because of the lovely weather, I feel exhausted all the time.
That's true. We try to pack everything into longer days and we aren't as good at slowing down. I think we speed up in the summer. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Did you want to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, sure. My name is Orla Reed and I am located here in Kildare, Ireland. I'm an accredited psychotherapist to the IACP. I'm also a qualified coach and addiction counsellor. The areas that I love working in particularly are working with women and alcohol freedom. Also, a lot of my training has been in sexology, sexuality and clinical sexology. And then I also work with women with different sexual disorders and then general women's and men's health. But for some reason, the large majority of my work is in women's health, whether it's menopause or relationships or endometriosis, chronic conditions. So while I'm very niche in the work that I do, it's still quite a broad spectrum. My practice is mostly online. I only see a couple of clients here in my practice at home. So I work with women all around Ireland. I have lots of clients in the UK. I have some in Europe, Sweden, a lot of Irish in the Middle East, and they like to work with Irish therapists as well. So while I'm here in little leafy Kildare, my niche or my clients are kind of across Europe and into the Middle East. So that's really interesting work as well. And I love doing these podcasts that are all about mental health advocacy. I became a therapist because I was always intrigued by psychology and self-help. I read all the problem pages back at Cosmo. I was that person that would stand in the shop, go straight to the back page to read the problem page. And I also love writing about self-positive health. So my whole world is kind of immersed in this field. Well, I like that. It's great. And of course, I listen to your podcast.
Well, thank you so much. It's lovely. I love it when people say they listen to the podcast, because it then means that you know the feel for the podcast and the conversation. So that's fantastic. And it sounds like, you know, the work that you're doing, whilst you say it's niche, I think it's very similar to the work that I do, in that you have a niche, but actually there are so many people that need that support in terms of the work that you're providing. For me, you know, mental health professionals with digital marketing, when I first did that, people were like, what? Like, that's so specific. But you then realise that, you know, everyone working in the mental health space needs support with digital marketing, because it's not what they do for their day job. So in a similar vein for you, you know, you've got your niche, but actually all women and men, you know, have health. So we all need support with that. And I wondered, because I know that today we're going to speak a bit about alcohol dependence and disordered eating. So I wondered how you got into, or what your interest was in terms of working with people with, I think, what you called alcohol freedom.
Yeah, I suppose, look, I grew up in Ireland. We have a culture, a society that is very much based around celebrating alcohol. We have a huge history of alcohol misuse and alcohol abuse. So you can't grow up in Ireland and not have alcohol influence your life in some way. And when I went into my training back in 2000, obviously something that comes up for clients all the time is how alcohol affects them, maybe how they're using alcohol, or a family member or a sibling. So regardless of the issue or the person that you're working with, alcohol is almost always a factor. And I never really went into my training with a plan to work on alcohol. In fact, I had thought that I would become a psychotherapist to work with eating disorders, because that's something that was familiar territory for me when I was younger, or maybe bereavement counselling, or work with child and adults. Now, as I went through my training, those things became less important to me, and in my fourth year degree was very much around sexuality and addiction based. I think one of the reasons why I stayed in the field of addiction, and even still, it feels like you follow a recovery process and a path, and it's relatively structured, and you can see really positive change happen very quickly. And when somebody gets a handle on alcohol in their life, everything else starts to adjust itself and correct itself, and suddenly things were a problem are no longer such a problem, or the person can handle them better. So I think that it's really only the last 15 years that I've enjoyed working with alcohol more and more, and maybe in my own life, having young children, working with women who are 30s, 40s, 50s, the challenges that they have with alcohol, trying to be the modern woman, have a family, have a full-time job, make relationships with alcohol is something that's ever present. So it's a profession that I've kind of adopted me, so mm-hmm. to speak. But then through that, you see lots of things like what we're going to talk today, disordered eating, burnout, neurodivergence, mental health conditions, history of trauma. So it's a really interesting field. And then, of course, we are in an environment where every day walking into the shop, there's alcohol there, or whether it's a celebration or a wedding, christening, funeral, triathlon event, you name it, alcohol is there somewhere. So it's something that people are coming more into therapy to understand their relationship, learn how to stop. Not everybody is going down the alcohol use disorder route. A lot of them are giving up because they want to give up, whether that's fertility or health or menopause, medication. And then there will be some who will be giving up because they've developed a reliance and a dependency on alcohol. So it's quite a broad spectrum.
It's really interesting. And, you know, when you were saying there about all the different times alcohol can show up, because I did a Tough Mudder last year. And when we finished, you walk through the finish line, you got your medal, and then you were given a can of beer. And I was like, that just feels so like off brand with the fact that we've just done this massive run and then we're being given alcohol. And, you know, I think that for me has always been the issue with alcohol, is it's such a normalized thing to drink alcohol. And a lot of my friends are now sober, and I think that the alcohol-free movement is definitely picking up pace. But I am in this place where it's a very all or nothing mindset in terms of, you know, you have like binge drinking culture or you have people that are sober. And sometimes I think that that mentality is almost like an eating disorder mentality, in that all or nothing, the way that we see people's behaviours play out.
Yeah, and you see, I'm not sure if you have the same in the UK, you probably do, but here in Ireland, the last 2 years, we have whole areas designated now to alcohol-free outside the off-license, and alcohol freedom seems to be the word that is fitting the Irish context more. So it's not about sobriety, it's not about recovery, it's about breaking free from culture and lifestyle that surrounds alcohol. I think that's such a positive thing. And, you know, if you're talking about eating disorder recovery, alcohol use disorder recovery, substance use disorder recovery, the path to recovery is somewhat similar. There are so many similarities. It's not about the absence of the disorder, it's about the absence of the disorder, but also the well-being, relaxation, diet, nutrition, social support, environmental structure. So when it comes to the recovery aspect, it's quite similar, just obviously with these different types of fields. But absolutely, I mean, the whole drinks industry is huge, isn't it? Absolutely huge. And I've had so many clients this past 2 years who have maybe gotten to their year and then they're really throwing themselves into health, well-being, they're doing the swims and the triathlons, runs, and then they cross the line, get their medal, and there might be a huge, I won't name names now, there'd be a huge beer tent there. And so hopefully that will change, you know. It's not going to change anytime soon, but it's so counterintuitive.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the point I was trying to get at, was like, you know, I've just done this. And, you know, no shame. Like, if you want to have a pint of beer to celebrate afterwards, totally cool. But I think it's more the fact that it's there and given out for free. You know, I would maybe more assume that there'd be, like, I don't know, in this day and age, like a kombucha stand or something like that, that feels more aligned with kind of, you know, the fitness industry. But in terms of your experience within your clinic, how do you often, or do you often see things like alcohol use disorder and disordered eating showing up for people?
Yeah, it shows up not when the person is drinking. It shows up when they start to give up on the recovery process. And I think when a lot of people have are experiencing alcohol use disorder, I guess their world is getting quite small. So they are often less engaged in community, they're functioning, they're going to work, they might be minding the kids, might be doing a bit of a walking, but alcohol is always present. And what can happen there is the emphasis is on the alcohol and it's never focused so much on the nutrition. So disordered eating will come up where somebody may have drank over the weekend. It could be Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It could be whenever. It's usually more persistent when it's alcohol use disorder because the effect of alcohol on the body. They're often not eating the same way. They're not eating healthy. They're often trying to restrict food because they feel bad that they've been drinking. And they might also be hungover, so they're going for the high carb, high sugar, high fat foods, might be drinking loads of caffeine. So they're often in this cycle of drinking, recovering, and then kind of binge eating or restrictive eating. And the person typically struggles with consistency across the board. We would talk about diet and nutrition a lot before they start to stop and when they've started to stop giving up alcohol, but it's usually so far down the list that it's not a priority for them. Other things are a priority. Maybe that's firefighting or trying to repair the relationship or any health implications that might be having. But for some reason, the diet and the nutrition and the hydration are so far down the list that it's not on any list. They haven't been paying attention to diet and nutrition. And that's the nature, I think, of alcohol use disorder. It takes the person further and further away from what's happening in their body. I have seen more and more people who are coming to counselling to get help with alcohol who may be neurodivergent. So often people with ADHD have much higher risk of developing an alcohol use disorder. They might have a tendency to be more disconnected from their body. So they're missing the cues that they're hungry, that they're thirsty, that they need to go to the bathroom. They are often really fit for 5 days, and then they might be binge drinking and eating really badly for 2 or 3 days. So when they're drinking and then the recovery, I'm going to say a couple of months into the recovery, that's often when we look at the nutrition piece, trying to get the consistency in hydration, food, the right food, the right time, in the right way. And there's such a learning piece for people around what does healthy eating actually look like, not to them, but across the board. Because most of us kind of learn how to eat from our parents or caregivers. So just learning how much protein, how much carbs, fruit and vegetables, when should I eat, when should I not eat, it's kind of a piece of our development that's often neglected.
We've all been there in terms of being hungover, having drank too much the night before, and, you know, healthy food choices maybe don't feel like the first thing that you want to eat. And, you know, I think it can often make you kind of just want to sit on the sofa, which can, you know, make you feel quite sluggish and, you know, just prolongs those negative thoughts. But I'm interested, because I totally hear that, but I think maybe a lot of our audience, or the audience that listen to Full of Beans, will have a slightly different relationship with alcohol, in the sense of, and I'm talking from a personal experience here, but...
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Often, I used alcohol as a way to numb and as a way to kind of get away from the emotions that I was feeling. But because I was drinking alcohol, I'd then restrict the food that I was eating beforehand or after. And that led to quite a lot of negative thoughts around that. And I've spoken to people as well that have maybe used alcohol almost as a purging behavior to make themselves sick so that they can get rid of those calories. I wondered if you'd had experience of working with those clients and kind of what the outcome is of that, because it's not healthy to use alcohol in that way, but I equally don't think it's healthy to fear the calories of alcohol. So it's kind of a difficult one to balance, I always found.
Yeah, the field of eating disorders, more so than disordered eating, it's an extremely complex field, isn't it? And I don't work with people with eating disorders, so I definitely won't be chiming in from a professional perspective on that. But what I would say is, at a very young age, food is really the first thing that we learn to regulate for ourselves. And so a lot of eating disorders develop at early age. First thing we can control, it's the first thing we can refuse, reject, and use to mood alter, use to self-soothe, all of these types of things. In a similar way, alcohol, in your early teens, late teens, it's the first thing that young people realize they can control to numb, restrict feelings and emotions, not deal with things, help them cope better with things. So in that way, food and alcohol are really quite similar.
Mm-hmm.
I've been listening to your podcast and also talking, you know, to other therapists, the complexities of having an eating disorder and an alcohol use disorder. There does need to be different approaches for each of them. that are supportive of each other. You know, alcohol use disorder, for some people, they can work through that relatively quickly. You can survive. We can survive without alcohol. We can't survive without food. So the eating disorder recovery is often a lifelong or much more prolonged experience going through that recovery process. So they are two different approaches. But to answer your question, it's interesting when you look at therapists, asking somebody about their relationship with food as part of an addiction assessment, probably not particularly high on the scale. I find with clients, no matter what they're going through, food is often something that as a therapist picks up that it's an issue for the person. Unless the person comes forward and say, oh yeah, food. If it's not alcohol I'm binging on, it's food. If it's not food, it's porn. If it's not that, it's something else. So I would see clients, they have characteristics of binging and purging, restricting, sometimes across the board, as opposed to just something specific. Often there are ADHD traits there as well, or neurodivergence. And really the person is trying to find their own way through, first of all, coping better with the emotions or the environment or the situation that they're in, but secondly, what's happening internally, internal process. Always trying to find some kind of balance in some way. As we know, alcohol is addictive, so it's very much progressive. Mm. And the more progressive it is, the less the person is eating, eating all the wrong things. And disorder eating comes with the alcohol use disorder, as opposed to usually being the other way around.
Yeah.
And again, and this is the reward cycle. I often say to my clients who are giving up alcohol, but they might have 6 bottles of wine in the press. If I knew there was a donut in my press, at the back of the press, that was going to be okay to eat in the next 7 days, and I said, no way I'm going to eat that. But the reward part of my brain knows that it's in there. And, you know, in many ways, I think the last 10, 20 years, we are living in a culture and an environment that is about quick wins, the rewarding, because the quick high, you know, we only have to look at our phones, the quick dopamine hit. So we forget that alcohol affects our brains in so many different ways. And it is a numbing, pleasurable, rewarding experience for that 15 minutes, hour, couple of hours, until it's not. And I've been noticing the last 2 years, and for me it's really concerning to see where disordered eating starts so young. I live beside a large petrol station just around the corner from my house, and it's shocking to see young boys. So before it was Red Bull, so it's at that young age, they're already developing disordered eating, drinking. They're going through the high caffeine, the high sugar content. It's cool, yeah, but it also is extremely rewarding and pleasurable, and dopamine hit and the caffeine hit and the sugar hit. So that's starting so young for them. And it's so concerning because it's extremely bad for their nervous system. We know that it causes high anxiety. The nervous system gets completely out of whack. Bad for digestion, sugar dependence, mood, hormones, all those things. And I find myself wondering, you know, is alcohol potentially just going to be next for them, because they've learned such a young age to disorder drink in that way. Okay, it's not alcohol, but it's the same, right? And that's young boys. I'm not sure that would have been around 10, 15, 20 years ago.
I mean, it's funny that you say that, because, you know, I think back to when my dad was 12. He's told me he was already drinking. So, you know, I question, were they not drinking the energy drinks because they had access to the actual alcohol? But I do think that, you know, you are right in the fact of, it's almost like a gateway. You know, if you think about gateway drugs, it's almost like a gateway drink, isn't it? Into, people drink things like Monster to give them that energy to engage or to do whatever they need. And I think, as you say, there's also that element of a social status, you know, being cool because you're drinking an energy drink. That very nicely then lends itself into going down the pub with your mates. You know, a lot of the time, I know for myself, I'd use alcohol as a way to make me feel more sociable, to put me on that level, because particularly when I was really struggling with my eating disorder, I was very depressed all the time. And it felt like the only way to get through a social situation was have a drink, lighten up a bit. And that was the way to engage. And I know that from the friends that I've spoken to that have gone sober, they said that, you know, the first few times that they went to a social occasion, they stayed for about an hour and they were like, I cannot do this. One, because they didn't have the alcohol to kind of bring them up to that social level, but also they just started getting really annoyed at everyone else because they could recognize the character changes. And then they said, actually, once they'd done that a few times, they actually then really enjoyed social occasions because they were being honest, they were being authentic, they were themselves. They gave themselves the recognition of, you know, if it got to 11 o'clock and they wanted to go home, absolutely fine. But then it also meant that the next day they could get up and they could live their life. So I think that, you know, it's a difficult thing to break that chain because it's so normalized in our culture to have a drink. I think it's definitely, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, I think it's definitely shifted slightly because for me, I don't really drink unless it's a big occasion and I'll either have one or two or maybe a few too many. But in terms of like regular drinking, it's not something I do. Whereas my parents, their generation is more like having a glass of wine with dinner every night or having a few beers. Like it's very normal. And I wonder if you've seen that shift in drinking behaviours through the generations.
Yeah, and we were talking about the age gap between ourselves, so there's about 20 years, mm-hmm. isn't there? I definitely see your generation, there's so much more of a focus on total health, well-being, lifestyle, and I suppose as well a type of autonomy in younger people that I definitely didn't experience growing up. I don't think that we realized we had the same choices back in the 80s as maybe your generation do now. There's certainly more options as well, isn't there? So I see a huge difference between those people who will drink at home and their glass of wine and younger people. That absolutely for sure. But there's also culturally way more to do. You know, when I was growing up, it really was just the pub on a Friday night. Now, maybe there mm-hmm. were other things to do, but that's kind of the way it was sold, whereas now you have all these lovely, in Ireland we have sober socials and walks, and we have a bar in Dublin that's an alcohol free bar, and there's so much more for younger people to do that has nothing at all to do with alcohol. So that just reinforces their reality where alcohol is a choice or an option, something they could do, and the big side not to, there's lots of other things that they can do. But I also see some problems around replacing food with alcohol, and that's another type of disordered eating where the person might not drink for the day so that they can drink less at night and have a stronger effect. And that comes down to the different reasons why people drink. That does change over time, but essentially alcohol is a mood altering substance and people use it to numb and to self-soothe and to self-medicate and to socialize, all these different reasons why people drink. But Hannah, there's also a reason why bars are so loud and hot and noisy. It actually encourages people to drink to be able to psychologically, physiologically cope with that environment. So there are all these different types at play, all these different things at play that pubs use that encourages or reinforces alcohol use.
I would have never even thought of that, but that feels, I mean, it's so true in terms of being able to, you know, manage those environments. But, you know, I always think about like fast food restaurants and they have like really fast music going on in the background, and it's so that you eat quicker to get you out the door. So that is really, really interesting. But I also think it's, you know, very valid what you said in terms of as the alcohol-free or sobriety movement, whatever you want to call it, is increasing, it's so much more accessible for people. Like I had a birthday party in February and I'd done dry January, and then I'd been on holiday and I'd had some drinks on holiday, and then I came back and got to the party and I thought, kind of here nor there with drinking, like I'm not really that bothered. And then I started looking around the room as my friends were arriving and I noticed like someone was drinking lemonade without a mixer, and then there was like 0% Guinness and stuff like that. And I thought, do you know what, because by taking in the recognition that the people around me were doing it, I thought, I actually don't think that I want to have a drink this evening. And I personally feel like I've reached quite a happy medium with it, because I now will occasionally have a drink if I want one, but it's not that kind of I don't spiral anymore, which was where I found it difficult. And I'm not drinking as a self-punishment. I'm drinking to kind of engage with friends or enjoy the moment, but I don't need it to enjoy the moment. And I think that's where you see a lot of people struggling, is that kind of dependency. And one thing I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned at the start that you work a lot in women's health, and I think that, you know, one topic I often hear a lot about is within menopause, women finding a difficult relationship with alcohol, but also, you know, a difficult relationship with food. And I've spoken to quite a few people who, you know, naturally through the menopause have gained weight, and therefore they're questioning their relationship with food, their relationship with alcohol, but often cutting out more food than the alcohol to then cope with the different symptoms that they're experiencing through the menopause.
Yeah, you know what, I'm seeing a lot of people, a lot of women coming in who, I guess what happens is they're coming into therapy because something isn't quite working for them, and they might be struggling with menopause. A lot of people, they don't realize that they have a problem with alcohol until they are encouraged or forced or recommended to stop drinking. And so when you think of these women who are coming into menopause, me being one of them, they've potentially never assessed their relationship with alcohol before. So they're often getting treatment for menopause. They might start medication for menopause, or it's not unusual for people to be on anti-anxiety and anti-depression. Alcohol has always been there consistently over the last 20 or 30 years. So I'm not sure that there is a direct correlation between problems with alcohol going into the menopause. I think that typically what I see is that the alcohol has always been there. It's just that the emphasis now is on, let's remove the alcohol to make sure your medication works well and that your sleep is better and that you're not as anxious and your tolerance to cope is higher. Have I seen women drink more because of menopause? Absolutely. But I think that when they start getting the awareness and education around menopause, that's when they start looking at their relationship with alcohol and food. Because again, when you strip out alcohol, they'll often say, God, I'm eating more, I'm snacking at night time. The focus becomes on what's going into their body and what they're eating and how they're feeling and how they're maybe using food to cope with that. There is a pattern when you give up alcohol of abstinence, sobriety and elimination, and a tendency to replace that, and it's usually food. And it takes a little bit of time to auto-correct the relationship with food and to change that as well. I probably sound very anti-alcohol, and I'm not anti-alcohol, and I've had my own experiences with alcohol. I think if I was to share maybe some of my own experiences, I had an eating disorder from, I was extremely anxious as a child. I used to always think it was an anxious attachment. I was anxious that something might happen to my mother, that I'd be left alone. And so because my anxiety was so high, I learned around that age of 6 or 7, I could actually control my anxiety by restricting food, because I also had a lot of phobias around food, sensory aversions. I had a fear of choking, a fear of vomiting, a fear of fainting. I just so many things going on in my brain at that really, really young age. And in my mind, it made sense. Okay, if I'm not eating, I won't feel so anxious. It means I've got to sleep better at nighttime. It means if I wake up at nighttime, there's nothing in my stomach that will make me sick. So I restricted food from a very, very young age. And this went on right through, I think, maybe until my early to mid-20s. But somewhere along the way, I discovered alcohol. And alcohol, in a way, replaced, not so much that it replaced my restriction of food, but it was suddenly a new way that I could control my anxiety, or like you say, numb out. And so slowly, the food restriction and the disordered eating and the avoidance food intake went down, and then the alcohol use went up. So one replaced the other. And I definitely see that pattern as well, particularly in women in their 20s. Even though I know this about alcohol now, it's been a journey to get to the point where you sit back and you look at everything to do with alcohol, from the cultural, the societal, and the alcohol industry, transgenerational education that we get, if anyone's experiencing problems with alcohol, let yourself sit back and think, what are all the factors here? When did it start? Is it affecting my eating? If it's affecting my life negatively, what might need to happen? How is my alcohol use affecting my diet, my nutrition, my food intake? We seem to be in a culture where everybody's obsessed with taking vitamins, but you know, most nutritionists will say if your diet is wise, you don't really need to be taking all of these. And quite a big area, isn't it? Once you start to dig in and sift through it personally, and then just
And I think that sometimes it's my issue with not necessarily the sobriety movement, although there probably is money to be made there, but I think with the whole health and wellness environment is that, as I said at the start, you know, we take everything to the extreme. So it's, you know, if I'm not drinking alcohol, then I've got to have this pure diet and I've got to, you know, only eat organic foods and I've got to exercise in a certain way. And I think for me, it's all about kind of reaching a point of balance where, you know, if you don't want to drink alcohol, that is totally fine. But equally, if you want to have the occasional drink, that's also fine. And not having this sort of stigma or shame, because I think often when we start thinking about, you know, all these supplements and everything like that, as you say, if you're eating a balanced diet, then you hopefully shouldn't need those supplements. But I do think that we can go to extremes with things, and then people are at risk of things like orthorexia, where they're just, you know, so worried and concerned about what they're putting into their body that then creates disordered eating. So it's such a tricky thing. And I think especially when, you know, you're talking about eating disorders and people with eating disorders, it's very difficult, I find, to have these conversations, because in my experience, if I heard somebody say alcohol was bad, I'd never touch alcohol again. Or if somebody said that cabbages were a superfood, all I'd be eating was cabbages. And I think that the traits that often people have with eating disorders is very all or nothing. But then, you know, when you're looking at a general member in the population, they can take things, you know, maybe more with a pinch of salt and relate it to them in their context of their life.
And listen, when you look at alcohol, the UK guidelines, if you're wanting to get a sense of your alcohol use, stay with the low risk guidelines. Now in Ireland, it's 17 units for a man, 11 units for a woman. So that's a good rule of thumb. If you're wanting to moderate and regulate and watch how you're drinking when you're drinking, that's a good way to do it. This is all about being informed and understanding your body. And I think it's also about being curious, you know, being curious, working out what's best for you. There's a lot of self-harming in disordered eating and eating disorders and alcohol use disorders. So to be able to sit back and say, am I harming myself? And in what ways am I harming myself? You know, in that way, they're quite linked. There's a tendency as well, you know, for people who are very fit and who are focused on losing weight and the diet culture to go for spirits because it's low calories. And yet we know that spirits are extremely high in alcohol, extremely difficult on the nervous system, the digestive system, the liver. So there are all of these types of nuances that when you sit back and look at, it's definitely worth exploring that. And understanding alcohol in your diet and the impact on it. But it's great to hear your generation going out and seeing people having lots of different types of options around drinking.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think to be able to take socializing out of pub context into new areas and avenues. Myself and my friends here, we go to sound baths in the evening, we go for sea swims in the evening. It's very rare that we would socialize now. Listen, I'm much older and my kids are busy and life is, I want to go somewhere where my nervous system says I feel relaxed. So we need to be encouraging young people to socialize in different ways.
Yeah, no, I totally relate to wanting to take your nervous system to somewhere that can relax. My peak place to be is hiking, and that, you know, gives me a high that no alcohol has ever given me. So I absolutely love that. But thank you so much for all of your insights. I think this episode has been really informative, and I think it's just a very interesting conversation about thinking about how alcohol fits into your own life and, you know, whether that's something that you want to have, not want to have. But also, you know, as you said, it's a very nuanced conversation. I don't think that there's a straightforward answer. So, you know, really evaluating and being informed, as you say, I think is a really important thing. So where can people go to contact you for more information?
Yeah, my website is oilery.ie and I'm on Instagram, the Wellbeing Psychotherapist. I host groups for women's health and women's sexual health as well. You can book all of those online. And thank you for having me on what is such an important topic, disordered eating. I think it's far more prevalent in society than we give it credit for in lots of these different ways. So it was a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, a real pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much. Thank you. If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.